Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The recent ceasefire in place now between Israel and Hamas in Gaza seems tenuous, but so far it's holding, and it's leading many in the region, as well as outside observers, to wonder what comes next. Well, we put that question to a longtime diplomat that served the Middle East as the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations resumed meetings last night. Ambassador Richard LeBaron was a career State Department official now serving as a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. Ambassador LeBaron served as ambassador to Kuwait from 2004 to 2007. Previously, he was the deputy chief of mission to Israel, and before that served as a minister counselor to Egypt. Recently, as a fellow at the Atlantic Council, he organized a two-year dialogue between prominent figures in the Gulf region and their American counterparts. He's written extensively about the importance of people-to-people links between Americans and Middle Easterners, and has written about prospects for Israeli-Arab reconciliation. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, speaking on a new model of U.S. engagement in the Middle East, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Ambassador LeBaron, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, it's great to be here. It's great to be in Tulsa. It's my first live outing in over a year, and so it's a delight to be here.
Yeah. Well, you'll be speaking on a new model of U.S. engagement in the Middle East. Before we talk about that, let's talk about the current delicate situation between Israel and Gaza. The ceasefire seems to be holding for now, but what is the prospect of it holding? I don't want to say permanently, because nothing is ever permanent in this region, but indefinitely.
Well, it's hard to tell. I think this has been a shorter conflict than traditionally between Hamas and Israel. We've been through this movie before. I was present for it at a time in Israel when I was posted there in 2001 to 2004, the Second Intifada, which lasted a long time and was quite bloody. So this is a smaller scale version of that. Nonetheless, it's worrisome because of the weapons used by both sides and the destruction that it's so easily rained down. But I think for now, both sides have made their point. And in fact, I think Hamas comes out with a pretty significant propaganda victory as representing the active side of the Palestinian equation. And the Israelis can claim victory in being able to meet the threat successfully with minimum numbers of injuries and deaths. But it's nobody wins in these kinds of things. So we'll just have to see how it develops and how people now move forward.
Do you think it was Hamas got a propaganda victory because of the disproportionate response and the amount of damage and loss of life?
I don't think that's exactly the reason. I think it was because they showed that they could take direct action against Israel. They showed also, which was a little different in this case, a lot of this started or was sparked by what was going on in Jerusalem. And Hamas was able to demonstrate that they could be somehow seen as a defender of Jerusalem, which is important not only for Palestinians, but for Muslims all over the world. So in that sense, it was qualitatively different.
And, of course, Jerusalem is controlled by the Palestinian Authority. The part that they do control is the Palestinian Authority. Hamas is not really, it's a minority player
right
in the West Bank. So this was propaganda for Palestinians in the West Bank?
Well, it was the Palestinian cause that Hamas became the standard bearer for the Palestinian cause. And this was shortly after, you may recall, that West Bank postponed elections or called off elections. Mahmoud Abbas, the president, was unwilling to do that, and that was a sure sign of weakness. He didn't want to have elections because he didn't want to lose elections and would probably have done so. So, it showed Hamas as stronger. Now, I'm not saying this show of strength was anything good or beneficial to the Palestinian people. I mean, Hamas sacrifices and knows what the reaction will be, and it sacrifices people in Gaza because it knows exactly what the Israelis will do when they react and that there will be civilian casualties. So, as I say, there are no winners here.
And what's interesting is this ceasefire took place even though certainly Israel said we did not achieve all of our aims in attacking Gaza, and I guess Hamas says, you know, we still have plenty of offensive capability to do this again at a moment of our choosing. Why did they decide to adhere to a ceasefire now?
I think because deep down, both sides know they're not going to win. And public opinion will turn against one or the other or both. In this case, public opinion was turning against Israel for the most part because of the civilian casualties, in my view, on the Palestinian side. But, you know, even in Gaza, Hamas is not necessarily very popular. I mean, it is a militant terrorist group, and people do blame it for the destruction and isolation of Gaza. So, you know, I think they calculated that they had gotten about as much as they were going to get out of this encounter.
Could you give your assessment of how the Biden administration reacted to this eruption of violence in Gaza? Did they do an effective job in mediating between Israel? And they're certainly not talking to Hamas on an official level, but can you talk about how they reacted to this?
Sure. I think there was a lot going on behind the scenes, and President Biden, for example, was in touch with Netanyahu directly at least six or so times during the hostilities. Other people were involved as well. He sent out Adi Amir, who was one of the officials at the State Department, who was responsible for that region. But keep in mind, Rich, also that a lot of officials haven't even been assigned yet. So their whole cadres of State Department posts, for example, Assistant Secretary for the Middle East, the Near East, they call it, who has not even been named yet, and other posts are empty as well. So there wasn't a deep bench.
Comes after 4 years where the State Department has been hollowed out anyway.
Well, exactly. So there was a lot. I'm not offering that as an excuse because, you know, you can find people to do the job when you need them. But I think there is a consequence for that. But on the other hand, the notion that this was a hands-off approach by the Biden administration, I don't think is true. Biden knows Netanyahu very well. He knows that Bibi doesn't respond well to public criticism from presidents. He knows that the relationship between Democrats and the Netanyahu administration is touchy. So I think all in all, you know, I would give him a B+ on this. And, you know, this is always, I mean, these sorts of things are always a crisis you don't need. I mean, you're trying to do all this domestic stuff, these huge packages of infrastructure, of economic stimulus and so forth. And here comes the rockets flying in from Israel and Gaza, and you've got to turn to that directly. It's not an easy pivot.
Now, President Biden was criticized on some fronts for not asking for a public cessation of hostilities. What do we know about his private diplomacy, and how did it likely differ from the public face of his diplomacy?
I think that, you know, when presidents talk to their counterparts, they can give them a little bit of texture on how what the other side is doing looks from the United States and from the political observers and people who care about Israel in the United States. And in this case, that played a fairly big role in a couple of ways. I mean, public opinion got almost as ugly as I've ever seen it against Israel in this case. And it unfortunately devolved into some anti-Semitism in some instances. And I think Biden probably said to Bibi, we can't let this thing go any much further. It's getting touchy over here, and I'm not sure where it's going. Because Biden's a very, as you know, a very moderate, old friend of Israel, Democrat. And he's probably as shocked as anybody to see some of the so-called progressive wing turning anti-Zionism into anti-Semitism, which is, you know, a strange thing to be even talking about at this point in our history. But unfortunately, it's coming both from corners of the right and corners of the left.
So if he was counseling that, what about his outreach to Hamas? I mean, certainly the United States doesn't officially talk to Hamas, but he also said he's going to help rebuild Gaza, but not involve Hamas, which seems pretty, you know, I don't understand how that will work. Do you?
Well, I was in Israel at a time when we actually had aid assistance going into Gaza. Unfortunately, we had to cut most of that off after we had some people killed, some security people killed in Gaza. by a roadside bomb. But there are ways of aiding the Palestinians through international organizations, through UNRWA, which was defunded to an extent by the Trump administration. So there are ways of doing it. Is it easy? No. Is it always successful? No. If we have another conflict and buildings get blown up again, sure, it's not great. But if Middle East was easy, we wouldn't be here today.
Good. My guest today is a former ambassador, Richard LeBaron. He is currently a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council in Washington. He served as ambassador to Kuwait, also important posts in the UK, in Egypt, and Israel. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on a new model of U.S. engagement in the Middle East. We'll talk about that in a moment. First, I want to talk about just the overall Israeli-U.S. relationship. Certainly, if you remember back to the second term of the Obama administration, and certainly during the run-up to the Iran nuclear agreement, relationships between a prime minister of Israel and a U.S. president were as strained, probably the most strained in Israel's history. And certainly President Trump reached out enthusiastically to Netanyahu and his administration over the past 4 years. Where are we today?
That's a very good question, and it's hard to answer, but I'll take a stab at it. This is such an important relationship, and it gets analyzed so deeply all the time. But what's happened in the last several years is the Likud and Prime Minister Netanyahu have basically decided that the Republicans are their partners. And so if we're going to blame somebody, I think we have to look to the Israeli leadership's behavior. I mean, that's a calculation they made. It's a tactical calculation. I don't think that Netanyahu has ever been a strategist. I think he's a tactician, basically. And I think those tactics are now failing him. And he can't even form a stable government for the fifth or sixth time. So I think that was the source of the problem. But that's not going to be, I think also there is an element of Israel becoming its own mature self. It is no longer as dependent on the United States as it was. It is a vibrant place. It is no longer threatened as it was. There's no combination of Arab states that could overcome Israel at this point, including the threat from Iran. And there's a great deal of confidence in Israel about seizing control of its own future. That's a good thing in a way. But I think people in the United States care about Israel. And I'm not just talking about the Jewish community. I mean, the Christian community in the United States is very devoted to Israel. Most people all over the country want to see Israel succeed. So I don't think it would be a good thing to deepen divisions that were carved out for somewhat tactical political reasons.
New York Times had an interesting article in just the last couple of days, which points out what you were just talking about, is that Israel has set about making itself independent in many ways of U.S. influence. Mm-hmm. Their defense industries are largely within the country and self-sufficient. They don't require us for arms deals as they did in the past for self-defense. The amount of money we give to the country is significant as far as our foreign aid, but it's no longer 10% of their budget. Exactly. It's more like about 1% of their budget. Mm-hmm. So have we lost that leverage of Israel as a key partner through a lot of times what U.S. traditionally does is having, you know, military influence, security influence, and economic influence?
I don't think we have, but it is in a more tenuous situation than it was. I think part of the influence we continue to have is Israel knows that we will always be there on its side. They don't know that about any other country. They know that the Chinese and the Russians will vote for symbolic resolutions in the Security Council, but take no other real responsibility. And they know they'll vote for them because they know that we will veto them. And so they'll sort of look good in their own public opinion, and we will take the brunt of public opinion. And I think Israel knows that, and Israeli leaders know that. But keep in mind that Israel, as an independent state, is the dream, you know. And so we want Israel to be independent. We want it to hold its own destiny in its own hands. And Israel, you know, we do not have any formal treaty of alliance with Israel. And that's not because there hasn't been a notion of doing that in the United States. It's because Israel doesn't want its hands tied itself and its freedom of action tied. And that's been a historic stand of all Israeli governments, that in the end, you know, and it reflects Jewish history, it reflects the 20th century, that in the end, all we've got is ourselves. And that's sort of the philosophy of Israel. This is a country that, you know, is founded for a reason.
Let's talk about another facet of this relationship between the U.S. and Israel. Biden's chief foreign policy aim in the run-up to his election, beyond ending the mercurial nature of Trump foreign policy, has been restarting the U.S.'s role in the Iranian nuclear agreement. That is something that Israel, and particularly the prime minister, Netanyahu, does not want, and does not want on in a vehement way. Mm-hmm. How does this impact our ability to, if things flare up again between portions of Hamas, Palestinians, and Israelis, our ability to influence that? Because I think Biden definitely wants a restart to that agreement.
I think the two issues are not really connected. I think the Israel does not see Palestinian terrorism as an existential threat. They do see Iranian, a nuclear weapons-armed Iran, as a possible existential threat, almost. And so I think it's in a different category. My own feeling is that there will be no Israeli government ever that is completely satisfied with any agreement with Iran that has anything to do with any nuclear capacity whatsoever. And so you've got to make a judgment at some point. How good can you get? You know, how good can we get? What kind of agreement can we get that pushes off the day of nuclear weapons capability, that surrounds the Iranians with pressure from the international community at large, not just the United States, but the complete international community, to rein in its activities and then enforce that, using IAEA and our own methods to enforce it. So it's a judgment call, and we, at this point, make a different judgment than the Israeli government.
After 4 years of this agreement being somewhat in tatters, if you will, I mean, certainly the will in Western Europe is for that agreement to come back. Not necessarily sure about Moscow or Beijing. Mm-hmm. How does that play into reviving this agreement?
I think in the end, the Russians and the Chinese realize that there is no interest in Iran with nuclear weapons. I mean, they can be supporters without supporting that. I think, for example, especially the Chinese, whose influence in the region is growing much more quickly, they see stability as their main interest in that region. So an agreement is in their interest, and I think they will be supportive.
My guest today is former Ambassador Richard LeBaron. He served as ambassador to Kuwait from 2004 to 2007. He's also a deputy chief of mission at the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv from 2001 to 2004, and served in Cairo as a minister counselor at the embassy in Egypt, and is now a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council in Washington. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, talking about a new model of U.S. engagement in the Middle East as we talk about the Middle East today. Well, before we talk about that model of engagement, I want to ask one last question, because this happened in the run-up to the 2020 election, and some people saw this as mainly publicity for Trump's re-election. And so I just want to ask you, you know, in the months leading up to the election, there was several announcements made from Washington, as much as it was Israel, of bilateral agreements between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, between Bahrain and Israel, Morocco and Israel, which was less governed through the U.S. How important are those bilateral agreements in sort of creating a sense of normal relations in the region?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, and I'm glad you used the word normal, because I've been thinking about that. And, you know, it's normal for countries to have diplomatic relations with each other. So my response is these agreements are good. Other Arab states should recognize Israel. And I'm, frankly, not in the camp that says they should be rewarded for it. You know, I don't think there should be additional arms sales just because you signed an agreement with Israel, or you should recognize, in the case of Morocco, some territorial claim they have. I think all countries should have relationships with Israel, full diplomatic relations, and just get on with it. And the fact that they've seen that as a tool, not having relations as a tool of leverage to help the Palestinians, I think is beginning to be very, very suspect as a working theory. It just doesn't work anymore. So I think we need to concentrate on normal relations on one hand and solving the Palestinian-Israeli conflict on another. And as we've seen in the past 2 weeks, the linkage between what the Emiratis did and their ability to influence any of this is very small. So I think we just have to focus on solving the problems.
Let me ask you about another sort of resolution of a crisis in the region that happened again right at the beginning of the year, and that is the supposed resolution of the Gulf Rift between Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which, of course, you know, that was a major flashpoint in conflict area mm-hmm. on the peninsula. How important is that development?
I think it's important that these states get along. I think their rivalries are often based on personal issues and political issues and issues of sort of whether they're getting enough respect for each other, from each other, and so forth.
You're talking
forth.
About personal issues between the ruling families?
Yes,
because
indeed.
Because they're mostly ruling families.
Right, indeed they are, but they you know, these are like, you know, any ruling families anywhere. You know, they watch each other very carefully.
It reminds me of all the monarchies in Europe at the beginning of the 20th century.
Well, they're not that much different. And so there's a lot of personal issues that go on. A lot of some of the issues relate to Qatar's supposed relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood, for example.
Yeah.
But the GCC states, and this is the Gulf Cooperation Committee, or I think it's committee, isn't it? GCC. They need to get their act together. They need to work together more effectively. They need, for example, to protect their sea lanes themselves with support from the U.S. rather than the U.S. in the lead. And that's one of the things that has to be part of the new normal, I think.
So you're speaking to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations on a new model of engagement. Tell me about your ideas for that new model with the Biden administration.
Well, in a sense, it's not a fully developed model. It's more like a few ideas.
Okay.
But I want to try them out on the Tulsa Committee. And one of the words that's come up a lot in our conversation today, Rich, is normal, the word normal. And when I served in Israel and Tunisia and Kuwait and Cairo, I would ask people, what do you want? And people would almost always respond, all we want is normal lives. You know, we want to send our kids to school. We want some predictability in our political leadership. You know, we want economic prosperity. You know, we want what everybody in the world wants. And the Middle East has largely been denied that, that sort of normal. So I think, you know, our ambition should be, in a sense, both large and small, because creating normal conditions in the Middle East is not easy. But, you know, it's not something that people should be denied because they happen to live in one area of the world. I mean, women in Saudi Arabia should be able to work, you know, if they want to work, and more of them are. And that's normal, but it's not anywhere near the normal level in the world. You know, people should, in Israel, should have normal lives, free of rockets coming into their cities. And people in the Palestinian territory should not be so much constrained by the constraints that are surrounding Israel's security. But that's where I start. So it's not a big geopolitical shift. It's recognizing that we need to work towards something else, and we need to stop thinking in great ambitious terms like we did in Iraq, where we thought intervention in Iraq would somehow change the course of the Middle East.
Bring democracy.
Right.
Right.
And everybody would see our power. It would see a new model. And of course, that was not to be.
You know, in a lot of these states, we have philosophical problems with talking with the leaders on the ground. I'm thinking of places like Libya or even Hamas, which we call them a terrorist state. Mm-hmm. And they do sponsor some acts of terrorism, but they also are sometimes the force on the ground that is providing schools and clean water mm-hmm. and health care. Should we abandon those sort of philosophical roadblocks to talking with those countries and able to help mm-hmm. those citizens engage in a normal life? Because in a lot of those places, they're taking to the Mediterranean to come to Europe.
That's correct. I don't think that there's a rule that says we need to talk directly to everybody. And I don't think we should offer the legitimacy of United States recognition to some elements who don't, in a sense, merit it by their activities.
Okay.
So I don't think there's one rule. I think, however, we should do everything we can to know what Hamas is thinking, just as during the Cold War, we did everything we could to know what the Russians were thinking. You know, this is common sense diplomacy, is that you go out there and you figure out what's going on. So we need to do a lot more of that. And we have ways as well. I think the United States, I was involved a little bit when we first started talking to the PLO. It was a very delicate, strange dance, but it wasn't impossible, you know, and it did lead to PLO recognition that Israel is not going away. So, you know, there's usually more domestic policy angst about these things than there is foreign policy. So it becomes enmeshed in politics in the United States. But, you know, it does. There's no one rule that always applies.
One of the other, I think, aspects of your model, if you will, or the ideas, is more people-to-people, people-to-people exchanges. Can you talk a little bit about
that? Sure. I've been involved with the Global Ties U.S., and it has is associated with the Global Alliance here in Tulsa, which runs an exchange programs, the Sister Cities programs. I think these programs are far more powerful than people give them credit for. I, as an ambassador, I would meet with groups of students who would come back from the United States. Their lives have been changed. And when I was in London, I would have senior officials who would seek me out to thank me, as the United States in a way, for the exchange program that they had done 20 or 30 years earlier. Because in a sense, it showed them the world. It showed them a new sense of confidence in what they could do themselves. And I think that's how we're going to affect change in the Middle East. Our goal should be positive change, long-term positive change. And that means investing in people. And these exchange programs, the foreign students that are on this campus and many other campuses around the world, around the country, it's a very important resource for the United States. And the United States is still a magnet for these kids. So I think we need to make ourselves open and welcoming. And we need to learn from them as well as impart what we have to impart from our institutions and people. But we need to think about the people of the United States, not just the of the Middle East, not just the leaders, not just the policies, not just the threats. In the end, it's people. It's people who will make a difference. And so that's what citizen diplomats can do for the United States. And it's very, very important.
Ambassador LeBaron, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Former Ambassador Richard LeBaron, a career U.S. diplomat for the U.S. Department of State, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He served as U.S. Ambassador to Kuwait from 2004 to 2007. Prior to that, he was the Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv, Israel. And prior to that, he was a Minister Counselor for 3 years at the U.S. Embassy in Cairo, Egypt. He's currently a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council in Washington. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, speaking on a new model of U.S. engagement in the Middle East. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.